This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. The title of this tape is The Jews and the Church. The purpose of this tape is to give to the listener some proper perspective of the relationship between the Jewish people and God's church, that is, the Roman Catholic Church. There have been, unfortunately, many misunderstandings, and frequently the Catholic Church is presented as anti-Semitic. As one of the problems with misperceptions is frequently an improper understanding of terms, that will be the first one that I shall define. Anti-Semitic, in its root meaning, means one who is against or prejudiced or opposed to those people of Semite origin. However, today it has become more properly a term to describe a person or an institution who is unreasonably and unjustifiably prejudiced against Jews. When we use the word anti-Semitism, we are referring to Jews and not to people who are also of Semitic origin, such as Arabs, etc. The word Jew itself frequently is the cause of much misunderstanding, so I shall define it now. A Jew is a person who can trace validly his descent from the union of Abraham and Isaac, Abraham being the patriarch mentioned in the book of Genesis, Sarah being his legitimate wife. In other words, the word Jew is a national term. It refers to a nation of people who have those two common ancestors. This is not the point to start getting into hair-splitting, determining how much of a Jew determines a Jew. This is not what we're concerned with. The key element to understand here is that Jew, Jewish, etc., do not refer to a religious grouping, a religious behavior, or a religious system. The system that many Jews adhere to and that many people associate with Jewishness and is therefore sometimes called Judaism is in fact a rabbinic system. It is one of the major religions of the world in the sense that it is recognized as a major religion both in its duration, in its influence, and by its membership. However, it is important to understand that Jews may be followers of Judaism. Non-Jews may be followers and members and adherents of Judaism. It is also important to understand that Jews may be members of Protestant denominations, and Jews definitely are, some of them, proper, valid, and loyal members of the Roman Catholic Church. One cannot change his nationality and his origin and his descent any more than a leopard can change his spots. One, of course, may change his religious adherence. Therefore, it is important to understand that there is no such thing properly as a Jewish religion, although one may argue with some validity that at one time there was. It is too well known of a story for me to go into detail about how God used Moses to establish a further development of the covenant between him and the chosen people being the Jews descended from Abraham. There is no doubt whatsoever that the Jews had a role to fulfill in the Old Testament, and there is no doubt whatsoever that a covenant, an agreement, a contract, if you will, was established by God, regulating the relationships between God and man. A development, a significant development of this, was an establishment of the Mosaic Law, which God gave to Moses and Moses gave to the people of Israel, or the Jews of that time, sometimes referred to as Hebrews. The key thing to understand about the Mosaic Law is that this part of the Old Covenant, as with all parts of the Old Covenant, are no longer in effect. It is important for you to understand this because although the Jews remain the chosen people in the sense that God cannot go against himself, the agreement between God and the Jews is no longer in effect. It cannot bring about the salvation of a human being. Rather than going into deep theological arguments about this, I would simply point out that the Mosaic Law is no longer followed by anyone on the face of the earth. I refer you to those parts of the Bible which succeed the basic Ten Commandments in Exodus. In these passages, it is commanded, I repeat, commanded by the Mosaic Law, that disobedient children be executed. I'm referring to the book of Exodus, chapter 21, verse 15. Whoever strikes his father or mother shall be put to death. Now, if this is part of the Mosaic Law, and it is, and since no one, I repeat, no one follows this commandment of God today, then the covenant, the agreement between God and man, which Moses gave to the chosen people, has been violated by man. If it has been violated by man, it is no longer in effect. And that is enough of an argument to show that the old covenant is dead, exhausted, no longer around. By definition, since man may be saved, he must be saved by a new covenant, which of course was established between God and the new chosen people, that is, the Roman Catholic Church. I point out that currently what many people consider the Jewish religion, Judaism, is in fact a rabbinic law system. I point out that even a cursory reading of the Old Testament will point out that the covenant, the Mosaic Law, was a law which included blood sacrifices at a temple for remission of sins, a male hereditary priesthood. The current Judaic system, Judaism, is based on rabbis who are teachers of wisdom, no sacrifice, no priesthood. It is an entirely new religion, having some similarities with the old religion, in the same sense that Catholicism has a significant number of similarities with the Mosaic system. But to consider it even based on the Mosaic system is a complete fraud, and is a complete lie, and completely dishonest. Much of the mistakes and much of the misunderstanding which arises between the Catholic and the Jew may very well be based on this. We must understand that Judaism, the Orthodox Jew, the Hasidic Jew, the Reformed Jew, the conservative Jew, whatever they want to call themselves, is in fact not a religion of God's making, but instead a human-devised system which was designed essentially as a social necessity for the Jews of the time who did not accept Catholicism to keep their identity alive, their nationalism, their sense of nationalism, after the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of Palestine as a political state by the Romans in the early part of the first century. Now, another point that should be clear when we deal with the concept of the relationship between the church and the Jew is that we are not dealing with the relationship between Catholics and Jews. We are dealing with the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Jews. This is a distinction which must be kept in mind. In the same sense that there have been Jewish people who have done bad things and have, to use an arbitrary example, defrauded on business contracts, this does not mean that one has had a problem with the Jewish nation. What this means is a Jew has done something wrong. By the same token, there have been people who have been Catholics who have maltreated or mistreated Jews. I'm sure that if we were to check the baptismal certificates of the concentration guards at Auschwitz and Dachau, we would find that at least a number of them were formerly members of the Catholic Church. Now, one could argue, as a matter of semantics or definition, could a real follower of the Catholic Church function in such a way to execute people who were innocent of any crime whatsoever and were being executed simply because of their birth? Well, I hold that in fact no such person could be a Catholic, but that is my own personal view. Again, simply because people who either were or appear to be Catholics have mistreated Jews, or vice versa, does not concern us in this particular tape. When the attacks come by the Jewish community, it is usually rendered against the Catholic Church. There is usually a charge, which of course is completely unfounded and totally false, that the Catholic Church has inherent in it a form of anti-Semitism, a form of prejudice, which is inimical to Jews. This, of course, is nonsense, and if one wishes to defend the Catholic Church, one must make it clear in the beginning, if one is defending it against a Jew, or a person who believes that defending Jews is somehow something to be desired more, or more virtuous than any other act, that you make it clear that simply because Catholics have misbehaved does not mean that Catholicism is wrong. Let me also point out that in Jewish history, I have taken it axiomatic, and I believe that any Jewish document, any Jewish historical record will prove this, the Jew has spent his life as a nation trying to keep the nationhood concept alive. As I pointed out before, the development of rabbinic Judaism was designed primarily to keep the Jewish identity alive. Of course, as we understand, the Jewish identity finds its fulfillment only in the Catholic Church. But throughout history, the Jew has essentially ghettoized himself. Even today, if one pays attention to contemporary Jewish literature in America, one will see that there is an alarm bell constantly being sounded by the very Jewish person, he who is more Jewish than the rabbi, so to speak, as we sometimes accuse people of being more Catholic than the Pope. These people are bewailing the concept of intermarriage between the Jew and the Gentile. They are bewailing the loss of Jewish religious and social customs. They are bewailing the loss of Yiddish, which is a characteristic of Jews in America, at least. That is a particular language which sets them apart. They are bewailing the loss of Jewish identity. Now, this, again, take it axiomatic, and I don't intend to prove that the primary interest of the Jew from the time of the diaspora, and if you're not familiar with that expression, what it means is the scattering of Jews throughout the known world, essentially as a result of various rebellions that the Jews had, unsuccessful, against the Roman Empire. The Jews, at that time, were considered by the Romans to be essentially uncivilizable. In other words, they couldn't be civilized, nor could they be successfully suppressed, and as long as they had their nationalistic and religious center in the temple, they had a strength which the Romans found annoying. So what they did was essentially destroy that center and spread the Jews throughout the entire world. If they had not followed this concept of nationalization, so the Jew believes, they would have become a race like the Carthaginians or like the Picts. In other words, footnotes in history books. But no one can show what has ever happened to these nations, or, so to speak, the 10 lost tribes, to make it a more appropriate example. The 10 lost tribes were carried off by the Assyrians and lost in history because their nationality was spread among the seas of many other nations. Again, I point out that the primary goal of the Jew for the last 2,000 years has been to keep his national identity alive. And I point out that if the Jew is to be believed in this, and there is absolutely no reason to doubt him, that that act which makes him particularly Jewish or tends to preserve the Jewish identity is good for the Jewish nation. That act which spreads out, assimilates, weakens the ties that Jews have for themselves and for their own identity as a Jew is bad for the Jewish nation. Now, of course, I make an exception for a case like Hitler. Adolf Hitler concentrated Jewish identity and certainly concentrated Jews in concentration camps. But the purpose there was for their destruction, not for their preservation. So now we have two elements for what a Jew would define as a good act. Number one, does it concentrate Jewish identity? Number two, does it perpetuate the preservation of the Jew, both as a human being and as a nation? Now, one of the other problems that have dealt with, I believe, led to a great deal of the confusion in this matter, is the attitude of the Jew. The Jew tends to think, if we are to believe anything that Jewish spokesmen say, that somehow they are still giving this special light to the Gentile. There is a man who is well-known in the New York area, and I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, but I think it's something like Ily Wiesel. And he spoke at Fordham University in the late 1980s, or 1990, I forget exactly when. And when he was speaking on the relationship between Catholic and Jew, and what he said was that the Jews still had a very special relationship with the Catholic Church, and that Jews special relationship was to constantly forgive the Catholic Church for endlessly fouling up relations between the Jew and the Catholic. I point out that there probably has never been, at least to my knowledge there has never been, a lawsuit which has been brought in federal or state court which has been inimical against the interests of the Catholic Church that has not had a Jewish organization as its initiator or its co-sponsor. To my knowledge, every time federal funds are taken away from a Catholic institution or a Catholic school or a Catholic hospital, a Catholic church, every time the Catholic Church is restricted in its good activities, there is always behind it somewhere a Jewish organization. Now, when I say Jewish in this case, I mean an organization which identifies itself as Jewish. What we have, quite frankly, is a subtle legal persecution of the Catholic Church by the Jew. Whether this is a constant act, whether this is a conscious act, I don't know. But it goes on enough for there definitely to be a pattern. At the same time, the Jew perpetuates the concept of being persecuted, being hated, being singled out by the Catholic Church. And it is important for us to understand this, that much of the difficulty which arises again over confusion of terms, but the current contemporary attitude of the non-Catholic Jew does not help things. By the same token, the unreasoning loyalty of American Jews to the State of Israel, which, if their emotional outbursts and their common behavior is to be believed, exceeds their patriotic loyalty to the United States, also makes Jews somewhat suspicious to those Americans who are normally patriotic. As Catholics tend to be normally patriotic, this is one of the problems that also arises. It is interesting that in a certain sense, the Catholic and the Jew both have a common background in this and face a common problem. Both are thought of by Protestant America as having a divided loyalty to a foreign land or potentate. The Protestant feels, of course, and still to some degree will actually voice his objection, that the Catholic owes a certain sense of loyalty to the Pope in Rome, a foreign potentate, which takes away from his sense of loyalty to America. In the same sense, the Protestant feels that the Jew has an unreasonable and fanatical loyalty to Israel. And in a certain sense, this is a much more realistic expression of a danger of loyalty. At least, of divided loyalty, that is. At least from my knowledge, no Catholic has ever been known to be spying for the Vatican, taking away secrets, and somehow passing them on to the Vatican or any other country, simply because that country is populated primarily by Catholics. I will, in this tape, attempt to use Jewish sources to point out that the relationship between the Church and the Jews has not been bad, and that the Church has in fact been a protector of the Jews and a benefactor of the Jews through history. The primary sources that I shall use are books written by a gentleman named Abba Ibon. Abba Ibon is a gentleman who is a high-ranking member of various Israeli governments, certainly identifies himself as a Jew, speaks marvelously, and was representative for Israel at the United Nations in, I believe, the 1970s. Those of us who are old enough to remember his frequent appearances on TV will remember how well he spoke and how eloquent he was. He co-authored and essentially narrated a PBS, that is public TV special, called Heritage, Civilization, and the Jews. This show, which was a multi-part series, was shown on PBS. I point this out simply for several reasons. One is, Abba Ibon by no means could be considered an anti-Semite or a traitor to his nation. Number two, that which gets on public TV gets on public TV only because the inordinate influence of the Jewish people in the communication media in America did not veto this project. In other words, if it were anti-Semitic, unbalanced in any way against the Jew, or in any way negative, whether true or not, it simply would have not been broadcast. This is a fact of life in the United States, that although the Jewish interest, that is to say people who are Jews, identify themselves as Jews and are sensitive of their Jewish identity, do not control the media by any means, but they do have a veto power over the media, in the sense that if they object to something, it is extremely hard for it to be broadcast. Therefore, Abby Eben's books, which carry on a similar process and present a similar story and contain much of the same information as the public TV special, could not be considered by any means anti-Semitic or could not be considered by any means impartial. They are extremely pro-Jewish sources. Number two, they are written, the books that I would refer to are written for the layperson. The public TV show was developed for the layperson. These are not detailed, petty, pedantic, dry, dusty, scholarly works. There are enough of those around dealing with the history of the Jews. Whether they really influence anybody, whether they're true or not, I think is irrelevant. The popular works, the works which are likely to be read, which produce TV shows seen by millions of people, are the basis of the impressions of the facts by which people make judgments. Therefore, by using these sources, I will give what the common impression of the Jew is, what the common impression of the Jewish scholar is, what they believe happened. And by the same token, if one were to quote these sources to a Jew in attempting to defend or explain the church's role, only a fanatical anti-Catholic could possibly find any fault in them. With that in mind, I would like now to give some brief, shall we say, historical highlights of the relationships between the church and the Jewish people. With this in mind, let me continue. One of the interesting points about the books by Mr. Eben is when he gives dates, and of course he's distinguishing between B.C. and A.D., he does not use those designations. Instead of A.D., he uses C.E., meaning Common Era. And he also refers to the dates before Christ as B.C.E., before Common Era. It is an interesting point that an attitude like this, in which the entire world has distinguished between B.C. and A.D., that Jews, rather than follow what is primarily a conventional custom, a legal custom, a traditional custom, will insist when they are distinguishing their Jewishness from others that they do not follow the Gentile system. I point this out as the Jewish characteristic of clannishness and of separation. The original relationships between the church and the Jews are found and detailed in the Acts of the Apostles, and one can see there that at times the problems between the church and the Jewish communities were significant. I will not go into detail on that. You can read the Bible yourself. The probable reason was two. Number one was the influence of the Judaizers in the early church. The Judaizers were people who, although they did enter the church, felt that in order for others to enter the church, they had to first become Jews. That is, they had to undergo ceremonies which would make them Jews, and then only baptism. And that the Jewish laws, regulations, etc., things like the dietary laws were still in effect, even though Jesus had founded the New Covenant. The second reason was that in the missionary journeys, the early apostles would first go to the Jewish communities, and in these Jewish communities, they would try to make their first converts, and of course, simply because one sees someone falling away from, quote, the old ways, that person is likely to react. So many of the early Jews had a negative reaction to the missionary efforts of the church. And you can again read this, that St. Paul particularly used to do a great deal of debating at synagogues with Jews, that is to say, rabbinic Jews. And the first converts of the church, of course, came from the Jews. However, the first time the word Christian was used was in Antioch, which was not a particularly Jewish city, although like most cities anywhere in that time of the world, it had a significant Jewish population. The point is simply this, that until the time of the earliest founding of the church and until the time that Christianity became a formally and permanently acceptable form of religion within the Roman Empire, that is, by the time of the ascension of the Emperor Constantine, the records don't seem to exist that there were, in any way that could be meaningful expressed, a formal type relationship between the church and the Jews. In other words, there's no record of complaints and no record of harmony either. We must assume that since there were periodic persecutions of both Jews and Christians at this time by Roman government, that all in all, they probably had highs and lows, but that there were no negative or affirmative things primarily to talk about. The first date which becomes significant is essentially the ascension of Constantine, at which time, although it is commonly recorded that Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, it did not, but it became officially tolerated, at first only in the West and then later in the East. At this point, the church came out of hiding, as it had done many other times in lulls of persecutions, but this time its hierarchy and its structure would be permanently public, its property would be permanently owned, and as an historical, continuous institution publicly allowed to exist, it would continue from that time until the present. And therefore we have some, at least, records at this point which can give us clear indications of the relationships between the formal church and the Jews. In the book by Abba Eban called Heritage, subtitled Civilization and the Jews, on page 107, he points out that Constantine prohibited conversion to Judaism on penalty of death, and that intermarriage between Jews and Christians was also permitted. Moreover, Jews were not allowed to own slaves as Christians were. He also points out, quote, to be quite fair, we should point out that these restrictions were not applied to Jews alone. There is mention of their being applied to Samaritans and other sects as well. The object of these restrictions was not to oppress other sects and minorities for the sake of oppression, but rather to protect Christianity. I point out here that Constantine did not become a Christian until his deathbed, and the point is that therefore this was a secular institution. This was a secular act done by a civil government and a civil ruler. But again, one sees this from the Jewish point of view as a Christian act and as a Christian sense of persecution or restriction. But again, I also point out that if the Jew is concerned primarily with preserving his identity, prohibition of intermarriage would work for the Jew's favor. It is quite true that the early church fathers wrote negatively of the Jews. However, one must understand that the early church fathers wrote negatively of everyone who did not hold Orthodox Catholicism. If they were to make an exception of the Jew only, and by the Jew we mean, of course, the rabbinic Jew, then they would be saying that somehow he who rejects Jesus is not immoral in doing so, and that somehow he who rejects Jesus can be saved, and that somehow this rejection of Jesus, this failure to accept salvation, is acceptable in the Jew, the rabbinic Jew, but somehow not acceptable in the pagan, or in the Doetist, or the Donatist, or any of the other rejectors of Catholicism. This would be, in fact, a form of prejudice and not a form of impartiality. So one should understand that the early negative remarks written by the Church Fathers and continued in the Church in many of its statements are simply a reflection of Catholic orthodoxy, the universality of the message of Christ, and the absolute necessity of the Catholic Church for salvation, and the acknowledgement, of course, that he who goes to hell has done so by a conscious act of will rejecting God, and that conscious act of will rejecting God is a sin which should be denounced by people who write theology, hold truth seriously, and advocate the good, the charitable intentions of all men. The next event that seems to be of significance in the relationship between the Catholic Church and the Jews is the pontificate of Pope Gregory I, also known as Gregory the Great. At this time, according to Mr. Eban, the pontificate, the power of the papacy, was no longer merely symbolic, but now had become real. So therefore, popes had some ability to actually regulate secular relations and the way things really were between Jews and Christians. Pope Gregory died in the year 604, and in June 598, Gregory wrote a letter, which is quoted by Mr. Ivan in his book on page 115, and it says, "Just as no one ought to grant any freedom to the Jews in their synagogues beyond that permitted by law, so should the Jews in no way suffer in those things already conceded to them." Mr. Ivan continues in dealing with Pope Gregory's letter, "Gregory's legalistic formula would often be quoted by later popes, and it was the willingness of Gregory and his papal successors to adhere to church law that enabled Jews throughout Christian Europe to appeal to the Pope whenever they were victimized by anti-Jewish outbreaks." Notice, Jews felt that the Pope was their protector against anti-Jewish outbreaks. In the second book, which I'm using by the same author, My People, The Story of the Jews, I note that on page 121 that the author says that until they were assumed into the Islamic Empire, they were to suffer some of their greatest agonies under Persia and Byzantium. Byzantium being the eastern part of the Roman Empire, where the church was always in a subordinate role to the civil authority. Now, interestingly enough, although they suffered under both sides, the author states that when Jerusalem was captured by the Persians from the Byzantines in 1614, many Jews had fought in the Persian armies against Byzantium, and in gratitude, the Persians handed over to the Jews the administration of the city. The Jews at that time attempted to rebuild the temple, but were unable to do so. The point here, interestingly enough, is this. Given a choice between the pagan Persian Empire and the Byzantine Christian Empire, rather than remain neutral, according to Mr. Ivan, the Jews fought in an anti-Christian war, taking Jerusalem away. And it is an interesting point to understand that the common reference or the common image of the Jew being the passive victim in all these wars between mighty empires is disagreed with by Mr. Ivan here, who states that the Jews took sides, and the side was anti-Christian, and captured the holy city of Jerusalem and put it under pagan authority, taking it away from Christians. Again, I think simply the point is that one should understand that the Jews are not blameless, or at least in a certain sense haven't done things to antagonize Christians throughout history. Mr. Ivan next thinks that the significant event in the, again referring to the first book, Heritage, is the rule of the Emperor Charlemagne from 814. At that time, it says that despite the his support for many Jews, the voices of militant priests during his reign and in subsequent period became increasingly shrill in denunciation of the Jews. This virulent anti-Jewish rhetoric was not shared by the general population. In towns and villages in which they lived side by side with the few with a few Jewish families, there was a relatively friendly relationship. Again, on page 119, Mr. Ivan states, "For the Jews of the European diaspora, Charlemagne was the stuff of legends. They would talk of the ways the emperor had favored their people, of how, as a gesture of thanks, the loyal Jews of Narbonne on the Gulf of Lyon, along the south coast of France, he had appointed a Jewish king to rule the city. There is more than a grain of truth in these tales." Again, we have the most Christian, the Holy Roman Emperor, the ruler of the empire established by the Pope, treating the Jews well, and we're now up to the year 814. Let us now deal with, I consider, a significant incident that occurred under Louis the Pious, one of the successors of Charlemagne. It says here, again, I'm reading from Heritage, page 120. "Events have now brought us to the beginning of the 9th century. During the reign of Charlemagne, the word Jew had taken on a new meaning. Not only did it signify merchant to many, but also one who is trustworthy and knowledgeable." Interesting point. I go on to the next thing. "We know from the documents of the reigns of Louis the Pious that the Jews were becoming increasingly important to French and German commerce. So important, in fact, that the market day in Lyon, by then a significant center of Jewish settlement, was switched from Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, to the middle of the week. Another more negative indication of rising Jewish influence was the torrent of anti-Catholic polemics that began issuing forth from two radical prelates of Lyon, Archbishop Abelgard and his successor Amelo, who had been called the fathers of medieval anti-Semitism. He then gives a quote from Abelgard complaining about the Jews, and it says in the next part that there is no evidence that Louis the Pious was swayed by these polemics, and when Abelgard took it upon himself to compel the Jews of Lyon to attend Christian missionary sermons in their own synagogues and sought to baptize Jewish children without their parents' consent, Louis summoned him to the imperial court to answer for his unlawful actions. Notice again, we have a situation in which a Christian king, if we are to consider Louis the Pious a Christian king, protecting the Jews in their civil and religious rights. And again, we are now in the beginning of the 9th century. Another event took place, and again, it's talking about the anti-Jewish sentiment, which was becoming popular in some areas. In the spirit of these words, a collection of anti-Jewish canons were submitted in 845 to 846 to the King of France, Charles de Gaulle, for his approval. Charles, however, refused to ratify them. Perhaps like Charlemagne and Louis the Pious, he took a tolerant view on religious matters. We know, for example, that he appointed a Jew named Judah to the high office of imperial ambassador. Again, we have a situation in which the Jews were being protected by outwardly Christian kings. And again, on the same page, which is page 121, Mr. Ivan says, whatever the reason, the Ashkenazim, that's a certain form of Jew, a Jewish, that's a synonym in this case for Jew, remained in relative prosperity under Charles the Bald and for another 125 years after his death. Now this means we're now up to the situation of roughly 950. We have gone through close to 900 years of recorded history of the Church and the Jews, without a record of an unpleasant incident occurring which was sponsored by the Catholic authorities. As a matter of fact, instead what we have is a record so far for 900 years of the Church protecting the Jews, of the Pope being the court of appeal and the refuge for Jews, of outwardly Christian kings protecting Jews, modifying laws to protect them and to change things and to make them more convenient for them, for using Jews in high places and for, as the quote says, allowing them to live or encouraging them or making it possible for them to live in, quote, relative prosperity. To give an overall view of the next 5 centuries, I refer again to the book My People, and I refer to the page 161. It says, by the 10th century, Europe had become the major ground of Jewish history and would continue so for the next 1,000 years. At the beginning of this millennium, there were not more than 1.5 million Jews in the world. The point he's making is simply that a great many of them were living in Europe. The next paragraph says, by the end of the 15th century, when the Jews had been excluded from the whole of Western Europe, with the exception of some parts of Germany and Italy, where political disunity prevented the formation of a single policy of discrimination, the largest concentrations were to be found in the two great Eastern empires of the age, in Poland, the home of the new Ashkenazim, or Northern Jews, and in Turkey. Well, I skip again. But the point is this, and this is the key sentence. In many cases, Jews were invited to settle in a town by the bishop or secular ruler, who might have entertained the hope that the presence of the Jews would aid the commercial development of his domain. Now again, notice, bishops have invited the Jews to settle into towns in which they had authority. As it says in a sentence on the same page, available records tell innumerable stories pertaining to the inception of each of the new communities which sprang to life in the Middle Ages. Now again, these are inceptions of Jewish communities which were invited to come into existence by bishops and secular rulers. We cannot really comment on a secular ruler unless for some reason we have to consider him particularly Catholic, but bishops by definition certainly are instrumentalities and officials of the Church. If they invite Jews in to settle, where then they prosper, where then they exist, when they have been excluded in other areas, then what we have is a situation where instead of the church persecuting people, now notice he said that the reason the Jews were not thrown out of Germany and Italy is there was not a political unity, there certainly was a religious unity. Therefore, we must conclude that the church acted, when it had the authority to do so, as the refuge place, the safe place, the place where Jews could flee to when they were persecuted. And therefore, instead of working on the theory that somehow the church was anti-Jewish, in this case, it perpetuated the existence of these people, or at least was instrumental in it. And again, this is something we should be aware of, because as we're pointing out in this case, this is of course a vast overview of a long period of time, but this is a 500-year period from roughly the year 1000 to roughly the year 1500. The same book on the next page, 162, Mr. Ivan is explaining why Jews tended to go into commerce and away from farming. And one of the reasons was, and I quote, "Now Jews also did not work on the Sabbath, and this enforced a two-day-a-week stoppage, often resulting in a serious crop damage. This was because, quote, the church demanded that both Jews and their employees refrain from working the fields on Sundays." Now, this is an interesting point and certainly could be considered anti-Jewish if one wishes to do so. And one may say, well, this prevented the Jews from working 6 days a week and their employees. But notice, what this was done was to enforce the law of God, if their employees certainly were Christian, that they not work on the Lord's Day. Now let us also understand something. If we judge it by the spirit of that times, then certainly I guess we could say that it was working against Jews in a certain sense, even though it was enforcing one of God's laws. If we judge it by the spirit of our times, where the five-day week is considered normal, and forcing someone to work 6 days a week is considered, shall we say, cruel, then the church was simply ahead of its times. This is not to say that this did not work a hardship on the Jews in the farming area and was one of the reasons they tended to go into commerce. But, again, which standard are we to judge by? And even in this case, if we take this as some type of anti-Jewish church action, one could say that if the church had allowed them to work 6 days a week while requiring everybody else to relax, it would have been considered discriminatory. And if the Jews chose to work not on Saturday, their own Sabbath, that certainly was their choice. And notice, they were not forced to work, they were allowed to follow their own religious convictions in this matter. Again, we are back in the book Heritage, we are on page 152. From the 10th and 11th centuries onward, there are established Jewish communities in most of the major towns of Germany and France. The Jews were engaged mostly in commerce, in which they excelled. For some time, they lived with their neighbors in relative tranquility. It was only later, when the national states were established in Germany under Frederick II and in France under Philip the Augustus, that intolerance prevailed. We're talking about the years roughly 200 to 250 in that case. During the interval of relative harmony, the great Talmudic academies of Germany and France were able to develop intense intellectual activity. I skip again, and I quote, I pick it up later. How shall we account for the descent of the Ashkenazim from the heights of scholarship and commercial prosperity into the maelstrom of murderous assault, false baptism, confiscatory taxation, and arbitrary expulsion that made Jewish life so perilous in the late Middle Ages? Okay, I break from the book. The point is, we are now dealing roughly from the year 1000 to roughly the year 1200. And according to this Jewish polemicist, we are dealing with a time of great intense intellectual activity, heights of scholarship, and commercial prosperity. So in other words, we are now up to the year roughly 1200, over 1100 years since the establishment of Christianity. And the relationship between the Jews and the Christians, in general, is one which has led to prosperity for the Jews. Now, simply from the point of view of a timeline, this certainly is more than half of the time of the history of the church. And for more than half of the time of the history of the church, the Jews have been treated well. They have prospered. They have been invited to settle. They have been protected by popes, by Christian rulers, and they have had legislation in their favor.
Of both books, I have had one what might call unpleasant, or one, shall we say, discriminatory rule. Okay. Now, the point I'm simply trying to make here, and I think I cannot make it often enough, it has not been church policy to persecute the Jews. It has not been church history to persecute the Jews. It has not been the characteristic of Christianity to persecute the Jews, again, rabbinic Jews, in any way whatsoever. And the myth that somehow this has always been a church characteristic. On tape, the Jews and the church side too. Again, a general remark from the book My People, dealing with the general status of the Jews, might be appropriate. It occurs on page 169 and 170. Again, the status of the Jews, having henceforth been determined by the Church of Rome and its representatives, whose double-edged policy was to insist on one hand on tolerance and moderation, and on the other to persuade the Jews of their moral and spiritual inferiority and to induce them to convert. Notice, what we have is tolerance and moderation and also persuasion. In other words, the Church never forgot its special relationship with the rabbinic Jews and never forgot its obligation to attempt to bring them into the way of salvation. What Mr. Eban is saying here is quite simply that the Church protected the Jews but did not give up on its missionary efforts. And on the same page, it would now be 170, what he is talking about is concepts of taxation as far as England goes. It says the total population of England, the total Jewish population of England, was always small. In 1200, the communities numbered about 2,500 families. But although the Jews constituted but 0.1% of the population, their contribution to royal income in ordinary taxation was estimated at about £3,000, or approximately 1/7 of the total. End of quote. In other words, the Jews were exceptionally prosperous in England, and now we're again dealing with the year 1200. These are just general comments to point out that Jews did prosper throughout Christian lands in these times up till roughly the year 1200. Perhaps at this point it's good to make reference to the First Crusade. The First Crusade was unfortunately characteristic by the slaughter of many Jews in various different places. And this was brought about, so the standard Jewish view goes, by the preaching of the First Crusade. The argument goes this: the Crusaders, having been inspired by Pope Urban II to go and rescue the Holy Land, instead of taking the long trip to the Holy Land, which was dangerous, instead fell on local Jews, cut their throats, and felt that they had fulfilled a crusading vow. There is no denying whatsoever that the Jews, many Jews in various parts of Europe, were slaughtered for absolutely no reason whatsoever by thugs. To call these people thugs inspired by the words of Urban II is absolute complete nonsense. And this is pointed out by a couple of points which even Mr. Eban in the book Heritage on page 156 points out. Number one, on May 3rd, 1096, Crusaders and Christian townspeople, a totally inappropriate statement, but nonetheless, inflamed by the religious revival, moved to attack the Jews of Spire as they met in their synagogue for Sabbath prayer. Forewarned, the Jews dispersed early, but 10 of them were caught by the mob on the way home and murdered, and one Jewish woman committed suicide. Bishop Johann sent in his militia to restore order, punished some of the murders, and gave the Jews sanctuary in his own castle. Measures that prevented further massacres in Spire, but could neither undo the earlier damage nor halt the spread of violence to other German towns. At Mainz, too, a local bishop offered protection, but he himself was driven away by an onslaught of burghers and crusaders. There are other references in history to bishops defending Jews at the cost of their lives. Now, the point is, quite frankly, this. All we consider someone a crusader who is actually, or a Christian town person who is actually driving away a bishop and violating sanctuary in order to kill someone else? No, what we're doing is calling someone a thug who pretends to be a crusader. And this is a canard, a slander, presented against the crusader movement from that time until this, and it should be clear that it is not true. In the same sense that Jews may do something wrong and that does not make all Jews evil, in the same sense that a black may do something wrong and that does not make all blacks evil, A person may call himself a crusader or pretend he's inspired by religious fervor and do something evil without it slandering and tarring with the same brush the entire movement. ARM produces a tape on the Crusades. We set you obtain it at this time. This was primarily a parenthetical remark. At this time in history arose the so-called blood libel. This is a myth in which the charge is laid against the Jews that Jews kidnap Christian children, kill them, and use their blood in making of their matzah for Passover ceremonies. This blood libel has arisen several times, and Jews have been convicted and put to death. We point out that whenever this has arisen, they were brought up on civil charges of murder, not religious charges by the church, and they were executed by civil authorities. Again, I also point out that, again, according to Mr. Eban, on page 166 of his book Heritage, in 1247, Pope Innocent IV called the blood libel false, and noting that should the cadaver of a dead man happen to be found anywhere, Christians maliciously blame the Jews. In other words, Innocent IV here was trying to suppress this libel, was trying once again to project Jews, and once again, we have an incident, or a case, an illustration of the frequent situation of the popes attempting to defend the Jews. Mr. Eban puts great emphasis on the situation of the Fourth Lateran Council, which took place in 1215. It says, in the main, the council did little more than attach its imprimatur to centuries of discriminatory legislation. But in one key area, that of dress, the council broke new ground. And then he quotes, we decree that such Jews and Saracens of both sexes in every Christian province and at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other peoples through the character of their dress. All right, there's a further quote, but now point this out. The Jews hereby are to be, if this matter is enforced, are to be distinguished from other people by the character of their dress. Whether one considers this a, shall we say, negative, it is certainly discriminatory. Whether one considers it a persecution, it certainly is, in a way, setting someone aside. But the next quote is very interestingly, and this is also from the council, particularly since it may be read in the writings of Moses that this very law has been enjoined upon them. Now notice this. The council is saying that the law of Moses requires Jews to do things, and therefore the council is requiring Jews to behave according to the laws of Moses. Rather interesting point here. And yes, the Jews were in many areas required to do this. There's no two ways about it. But again, dealing further with the institution of the papacy and the Jews, I point that on page 155 of the same book, Mr. Eban states that when Aton Colonna ascended to the papacy in 1417 as Martin V, delegations of Jews called upon him to offer their regards and to plead for confirmation of their traditional privileges, which Pope Martin readily granted. Like many popes, Martin employed a Jewish physician and enjoyed favorable personal relationships with the Jews. Regardless of his personal relationships, the fact is that he confirmed privileges given to the Jews, and once again, the Pope being the head of the Church, it is really only he and other Church officials that can be considered reflecting the actual relationship between the Jews and the Pope. It is also pointed out on page 164 that when the Magna Carta was imposed upon King John, it says here, a clause in the Magna Carta, the Charter of Liberties forced upon King John by his barons in 1215, limited the claims of Jewish moneylenders against the estate of landowners who had died in debt. It is interesting to point out that the Pope invalidated the Magna Carta, therefore, once again, although maybe not intentionally, certainly in fact, upholding Jewish rights. Once again, Jewish rights were restricted by the civil authority, upheld by the papal authority. Eban points out that at the time of the Black Death, the horror which struck Europe in the 1300s, that many people began to accuse Jews of spreading this disease, and that Jews were suffered on account of it. It says here, however, in a papal bull issued September 26, 1348, Clement VI contended that, quote, and I'm quoting the papal bull, since this pestilence is all but universal everywhere, and by a mysterious decree of God has afflicted and continued to afflict both Jews and many other nations throughout the diverse regions of the earth to whom a common existence is unknown, the charge that Jews have provided the cause or occasion for such a crime is without plausibility. Again, once again, here is the papacy defending the Jews from common charges brought about them by ignorant people, so that Jews would once again not be treated in an unfair, in a discriminatory, or in a dangerous fashion. Mr. Ivan also points out in the next paragraph that the papacy, shrunken and exiled, was no match for the fearful power of popular imaginings. And that's a very interesting point. Notice again, the Jews certainly did suffer at this time, but it was not the papacy that brought it about directly, and instead by several of these comments, which Mr. Ivan feels, shall we say, compelled to bring up in his own book. It is the papacy, the strong inherent instrumentality of the Church, which attempts to defend the Jews, which attempts to protect the Jews, which attempts to give privileges to the Jews, rather than that being the force which made life for the Jews difficult. Simply one more incident to this, again page 163 in the book Heritage. It says that Philip II, who reigned from 1180 to 1223, who carved out the modern French state at the expense of King John of England, and to the considerable pleasure of Pope Innocent III, began his reign by ordering the imprisonment of all Jews within his realm. It's interesting to know that they were freed. Now, again, the considerable displeasure of Innocent III. If the Pope's view, if the Church's view were that Jews were given no human rights, if they were to be deprived of everything, if they were to be persecuted, why would Innocent III express his considerable displeasure when Jews were imprisoned by a secular authority? Once again, the only explanation is that the popes consider themselves obligated to protect Jews in their civil and their moral rights, their human rights, in the same sense that popes, proper popes, correct popes, have understood the role of the Church to always protect the defenseless. I attempt to give something of the Jewish mentality of the times, or Mr. Ivan considers the Jewish mentality of the times. I would like to read a brief quote from, again, the book Heritage, and the pages are 158 to 159. I start with, and this is dealing with a apparent attempted a forcible conversion of a Jewish family that took place during the time of the Crusades. I quote, accustomed by tradition to regard martyrdom as not only commendable, but mandatory under extreme provocation, the Ashkenazim held high praise for pious Rachel, who, when the Crusaders stormed Mainz, preferred to have her own children slain rather than see them forcibly baptized and raised as Christians. Three of her children, the boy Isaac, the two girls Bella and Matrona, submitted meekly to the slaughter, but the fourth child, Aaron, ran away, screaming, Mother, Mother, do not butcher me. When this righteous woman, now he's quoting from a source, when this righteous woman had made an end of sacrificing her three children to their Creator, she then raised her voice and called out to her son, Aaron, Aaron, where are you? You also I will not spare, nor will I have any mercy. She then dragged him out by the foot from under the chest where he hid himself, and then she sacrificed him before God, the high and exalted. End quote. I point out that the killing of a children by her mother, by their mother, is a bizarre act. It is a sinful act. It is a blasphemous act to think that somehow you're sacrificing to these children to God. The point is that the Jews praised this woman, considered her pious, and Mr. Ivan felt that it was good to put it in the book as an act of heroism, presents a bizarre system and certainly a blasphemous view, which I think has prejudiced, or gives certainly evidence of the prejudice of the Jewish mind towards Christian morality and towards true morality. This is a perverted value system if one is to praise not only suicide, but to praise killing of innocent children. That somehow it is better to be dead than to be a Christian. Now bear that in mind when you understand the discriminatory regulations as involving the ghettos and involving the discriminatory dress.
To continue briefly with this concept of the Crusaders and the Jews, I once again refer to the book Heritage, and I'm on page 162 to 163. So this relative absence of violence, especially in France, but also in the Vineland, only a few Jews were massacred at Mainz and Worms in 1147, we may credit the preaching of the French ecclesiastic Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, the spiritual leader of the Second Crusade. Bernard made it clear that violence towards Jews and seizure of their property would not be tolerated. When a Cistercian monk named Rudolf began agitating against them, Bernard himself went to the Rhineland to bring Rudolf under control. I will now read from a different book, The Story of Civilization by Will Durant. I have the volume called The Age of Faith, and I'm on page 390. And I will read briefly again on the same subject. Arrived at Spire, the Christians dragged 11 Jews into a church and ordered them to accept baptized. Refusing, 11 were slain. Other Jews took refuge of the city, took refuge with Bishop Johansen, who not only protected them, but caused the execution of certain crusaders who had shared in the murder at the church. Some crusaders neared Tyre. Each Jew appealed to Bishop Engelbert. He offered protection on the condition of baptism. Most of the Jews consented, but several women killed their children and threw themselves into the Moselle. At Mainz, Archbishop Luthorp hid 1,300 Jews in his cellars. Crusaders forced their way in and killed 1,014. The bishop was able to save a few by concealing them in the cathedral. Four Mainz Jews accepted baptism, but committed suicide soon after. As the crusaders approached Cologne, the Christians hid the Jews in their home. The mob burned down the Jewish quarter and killed the few Jews upon whom they could lay their hands. Bishop Hermann, at great danger to himself, secretly conveyed Jews from their Christian hiding places to Christian homes in the country. The pilgrims discovered the maneuver, hunted their prey in the village, and killed every Jew they found. In two of these villages, 200 Jews were slain. At Worms, Bishop Alabranches received such of the Jews as he could into his palace and saved them. Upon the rest, the crusaders fell with the savagery of anonymity, killing many. Again, the situation is repeated over and over and over, that bishops, churchmen, save the Jews, and these thugs, pretending to be crusaders or pilgrims, kill them. The Second Crusade threatened, I'm reading again, the Second Crusade threatened to better the example of the first. And now I'm skipping a point here. A French monk, Rudolphe, leaving his monastery without permission, preached a pogrom in Germany. And here, again, as Mr. Rebon said, the Archbishop appealed to, again, what it says here is Archbishop Henry at Mainz admitted into his house some Jews pursued by a mob. The mob forced a way in and killed them before his eyes. The Archbishop appealed to Saint Bernard, the most influential Christian of his time. Bernard replied with a strong denunciation of Rudolf and demanded an end to the violence against the Jews. When Rudolfo continued his campaign, Bernard came in person to Germany and forced the monk to return to his monastery, which he had left without permission. I bring these things up only to point out that Saint Bernard, being one of the greatest saints of the Church, certainly denounced and tried to prevent any damage, any persecution, any slaughter of the Jews. By the same token, these archbishops and bishops, who are simply names and footnotes in historical textbooks, in other words, routine bishops, routine archbishops, also risked their very lives to save Jews. I have another point here on page 391 of Mr. Durant's work, which I think is interesting. In Bohemia, 150 Jews were murdered by the Crusaders. After the terror had passed, the local clergy did what it could to help the surviving Jews. And those who had accepted baptism under duress were allowed to return to Judaism without incurring the dire penalties of apostasy. Once again, we have even a guarantee of religious freedom by the Church of the Jews against both mob violence and secular oppression. This pattern repeats itself throughout history, And once again, I can only continue to say that this myth that somehow it was the church or churchmen or typical Catholics or the normal Catholic behavior to oppress Jews or to force them into baptism or conversion is complete and utter nonsense.
Again, to put the matter into context, I'm dealing with page 180 of Abba Eben's book, My People. He's talking about how anti-Semitism became common in Europe after the Fourth Lateran Council. To the Lateran Councils must be laid the blame for the anti-Semitic epidemics that swept Europe in the 13th and 14th centuries. Outbursts predicated on the allegation which the higher clergy knew to be false, but for which they had already paved the way. Once these outbursts had been set in motion, nothing the Pope or the bishops might say could impede their awful consequences. Indeed, the princes of the Church frequently remained silent, and by so doing, let an air of complicity to the unrestrained fury of the mob. Papal bulls decrying the slaughter of the Jews were no avail. End of quote. Well, the point is, if there were papal bulls decrying the slaughter, then the princes of the Church were not remaining silent. It's an interesting point, again, how the Jewish historian wishes to take a prejudiced point of view, always putting the Church in a negative light. But by the same token, he admits that there were papal bulls decrying the slaughter of the Jews. And if, as he points out, they were of no avail, then it was not the Church who brought them about, but the Church which was unable, because of its lack of physical power, its lack of political authority, to stop these unfortunate situations. One of the greatest sore points between the Jew and the Catholic, and again I say Jew, I mean the rabbinic Jew, is the expulsion of rabbinic Jews from Spain in 1492. Now, many people fail to understand the historical context in which this took place and think of 1492 merely as the year in which Columbus discovered America, but three events very important in Spanish history took place in this year. The first, of course, was the discovery of America by Christopher Columbus. The second was the expulsion of the Moors, the Saracens, from their last stronghold in Granada in Spain. And the third is the expulsion of the Jews. Now, briefly, to understand it, Visigothic Spain had been invaded in the early 8th century, that is, in the early 700s, by invaders from Africa. Most of the Iberian Peninsula was conquered by these Muslim invaders, and Christianity became a persecuted religion. They brought with them, or at least allowed to settle on that territory, a large number of Jewish immigrants. The Jews at that time rose to various different degrees of prominence, subject to periodic persecution underneath the Islamic rulers. The reconquest began almost immediately. So in other words, for over 700 years, the Spanish character was formed by one thing, that is the expulsion of the Islamic invaders and the reconquest of Spain to its native people and to Catholicism. This was finally brought about in 1492. Now, at this point, Ferdinand and Isabella, the rulers of reunited Spain, decided, rightly or wrongly, that in order to unify the nation, which had just been rebirthed, so to speak, had been reborn now as a Catholic nation, and to prevent a fifth column, that is to say, a series of suspect people behind who would not be united behind the throne, they decided that they would base their unifying principle of their nation on religion. So therefore, they offered to the non-Catholics the alternatives of conversion or expulsion. In other words, become a Catholic or exile yourself. It doesn't really matter exactly what the numbers were that were involved, nor does it matter at this point whether such an activity was justified. The point is, it occurred, and it was done by the civil authorities who certainly had a great deal and a great affinity for the Church, but it was a civil activity undertaken by people who were Catholics and should be judged in a civil manner. One of the characteristics of the resulting history, which people do not talk about, is that many of the Jews, who were then called conversos, did convert, at least formally, to Catholicism. It is not exactly for us to say whether they were actual Catholics or not. Only God can judge such a thing. But these conversos did, in fact, rebel a short time later in the next generation and did threaten the national existence of Spain. Now, whether they rebelled because they were forced into a religion they didn't like, and whether they would have rebelled if they had been allowed their own freedom of religion, we don't know. And this is something that no one can explain because it's one of these unanswered questions of history. But the point is, the expulsion of the Jews, which led to many hardships on the part of the Jews that were expelled, and probably a significant amount of suffering and death, was a political act decided by Ferdinand and Isabella to bring about national uniformity of a nation which had just conquered its own territory after having been virtually exiled from it, so to speak, for over 700 years. And, of course, at that point, needed a unifying principle to bring about this newly refounded Spain on a more firm principle than simply sharing the same land. Again, this was not a Catholic, that is to say, a church decision. It was a civil decision. One may argue again whether it's justified or not, but to attribute the sufferings of the exiled Jews to the Catholic Church here is completely unfounded and, to put it as mildly as possible, very stupid. And if people do it, they simply are either ignorant, which no one can be anymore listening to the background of this event, or they are, in fact, simply anti-Catholic, the latter most likely being true.
There's an undeniable characteristic of the Jewish life, the Jewish history, in the Christian countries that frequently they were required or legislated to live in certain separate areas, usually known as ghettos. I read from page 165, Abba Eban's book, My People. Communal self-determination was facilitated in Europe by the penchant for segregated living which characterized medieval society in general. That Jews wished to live apart from the rest of the population was thus pretty much taken for granted, although it was also a major goal of rabbinic law to prevent any undue infiltration of Gentile ways of life into the community. The Jews themselves often welcomed the assignment of segregated quarters as a distinct favor, particularly if those quarters, or juderes, as they were known in Spain, were located in fortified places. In 1084, Bishop Rugutta of Speyer even considered the establishment of such a separate Jewish quarter surrounded by a wall as a means of attracting Jews and hence enhancing the city's prestige and trade relations. These quarters by no means constituted ghettos in the strict meaning of the term. Numbers of Jews were always to be found living outside of them, and non-Jews frequently established residence within the Jewish quarter. Legislation enforcing segregation was yet to come, and when it did, it was invariably a sign that the natural social barriers had become so weak as to threaten the status of the majority. But before 1200, the majority of Jews in almost every town voluntarily congregated in a separate sector of their own, where they could more fully enjoy the educational and religious facilities and amenities of life offered by a spiritually and socially homogeneous group. Again, the point here is that it was a natural tendency reinforced by both rabbinic law and natural social inclinations for the Jews to segregate themselves. Therefore, when the ghetto arose, it was a natural outgrowth of something desirable for the Jews, and I go back to the same basic principle, if their existence as a people is good, then ghettoization helped them achieve this. The first ghetto apparently took place in Venice, and it was a walled city in which Jews were placed, literally, for their protection at night. It was also, again, designed to bring about a distinction, shall we say, between the two. As Mr. Eban puts it in his Heritage book, the original ghetto, a walled quarter where the Jews were locked in at night by a gate that was locked at sunset, was born in Venice in 1516 at the site of an old iron foundry. As an institution, the ghetto defined Jewish life in Venice and many other cities in Western Europe from the 16th century through the 18th century. That's on page 177. So the ghetto, of course, became part of the Jewish culture, part of the Jewish life, part of the existence in Christian lands. But notice, of course, the date, 1516. And this is when we shall stop our strict historical survey. For in 1517 began the Protestant Rebellion. At this point, the unity of Christendom, in so much as it ever existed, was split. And at this point, the secular power of the Church, in so much as it still existed whatsoever, was virtually destroyed except for the Papal States. And at this point, what we have is a secular history of the Jews in which the relationship of the Jew and the Roman Catholic Church becomes a factor of no significance in the treatment of the Jews, which has become a very, very significant issue, is the matter of Martin Luther and the relationship between the Protestant denominations and the Jews. I point out to the listener that, number one, there were no state religions in Christianity at all, except at the very later part of the Roman Empire, in the West, that is. It continued in the East under the Byzantine, but that was not Roman Catholicism. It was a form of Catholicism until the final break, 1054, but it was never Roman Catholicism. And number two, that the Protestants brought about the state religion, that is, a religion that is both bolstered by and controlling the state, or controlled by the state. It was the Protestant Reformation, if you wish to call it that, which brought about the concept that the religion of the prince should be the religion of the people, and that state and prince and religion are all one. From then on, if it were a Protestant situation where the Jew was having problems, then truly it could be considered a problem between the religion of the people and the ruler, that is to say, the Protestant religion and the Jews. But if they were having a problem in a Catholic country, that is a country where the predominant religion was Catholicism, by no means could one consider it a problem between Catholicism or the Catholic Church and the Jews. Because in none of the Catholic countries, from the time of roughly 400 A.D. until the current time, has there been a state religion in any Catholic country, the only exception being, of course, the Papal States. And by state religion, I mean state religion as it was practiced in England, in the German principalities, which became Lutheran, in Norway and Sweden, etc. In those places, the religion truly did influence and determine the politics, and the politics did truly influence and determine the religion. So the point is, in dealing with the history of the Church, that is the Catholic Church, and the Jewish people, that is the rabbinic Jewish people, the history itself must properly end at the time of the Protestant Reformation. And that's what we have done in this brief survey, is to give some of the high points from primarily Jewish points of view to explain how the relationships have gone about. Let me again, if I may at this point, summarize what I consider a few of the highlights. Number one, all of the papal statements mentioned by Mr. Eban in his two books, in which he tries to deal with the history of the Jews from a popular meaning commonly understood point of view, deal with papal statements defending the Jewish people, defending their civil rights, defending their freedom, defending their right to exist, their right to worship, their right to exercise their basic human rights. In other words, totally in keeping with Catholic doctrine, that the Catholic Church is the mother of the oppressed and the protector of the helpless. Number two, although at various different times, evil people, or people who have behaved in evil fashion, have used the mantle of the Church or Catholicism in order to kill, oppress, and despoil Jews, at no times could any of this be laid directly to Roman Catholic policy or Roman Catholic theology or Roman Catholic behavior that is distinctly Roman Catholic. Again, many churchmen, many saints, have defended Jews, including up to at the cost of their lives. Many Catholics, people, have defended Jews. And again, I point out that one is to understand that when you behave in accord with your religion, you can consider it a religious act. When you behave against the principles of the religion, you cannot blame the religion for the acts of the person who goes against it. I point out again that Jewish people have done bad things. That does not make all Jews, either rabbinic or true Jews, evil. The highlights, again, are a record of protection, a record of toleration, a record of refusal for forced conversion. Forced conversions have taken place. They have never taken place under official Catholic auspices. Again, the primary causes of anti-Semitism in America and in Europe today go directly from the teachings of Martin Luther. Martin Luther, a tape on him is available from ARM, was probably the most rabid anti-Semite before or after Adolf Hitler. Almost all of Martin Luther's teachings were put into effect by Adolf Hitler, and he is the spiritual father of Adolf Hitler and all radical anti-Semitism in Europe, period. Because radical anti-Semitism did not exist in Europe. Periodically it rose up. But as Mr. Ibon makes clear in his books, almost always there were economic bases for these. In other words, the Jews were rich, people owed them money, so therefore they tried to either kill the Jew or dispose him of his legal rights. The example he gave is the Magna Carta. But Martin Luther hated the Jews because Martin Luther hated people. And I will not go into great detail on some of the things he said. I simply refer you to the tape available from it. Also, many Jews have pointed out that the Inquisition, primarily the Spanish Inquisition, was a great, terrible thing for them. This, of course, is perfectly not true. ARM also produces a tape on the Inquisition. I will refer you to it, and I will simply say at this point that the Inquisition dealt only with Catholics. It dealt not with rabbinic Jews at all. It had no jurisdiction over them, no power to persecute them whatsoever. So therefore, if they are talking about Jews who converted to become Catholics, then they were Catholic Jews, and not being persecuted or dealt with by the Inquisition or punished by the Inquisition or acquitted by the Inquisition because they were Jews, but because they were Catholics. Again, when we use the word Jew in this tape, as most people use the word Jew, and as Mr. Ibon uses the word Jew, he's talking about the followers of Judaism and Rabbinic Judaism, which again is a religion not founded by Moses. I hope that in this brief survey you have been given enough information and enough ammunition, so to speak, to understand and defend the Church's position with the Jew throughout history. When the Church has been strong, when the Church has been obeyed, when the Church has taught and men have listened, the Jew has prospered. The Jew has been treated well simply because of two reasons. Number one, he is a brother to us as Jesus is all of our, he is the brother to all. We have all the same Heavenly Father. And of course, we have the same Heavenly Mother. So therefore, all men are our brothers. All men are to be treated as our brothers should be treated. All men have basic inherent human rights, and all men are capable of salvation. All men are specific creations of God. But secondly, it is through the Blessed Mother to Jesus that the Jews themselves are the blood relatives of our Savior. They are no longer the chosen people in the sense that they were the people to bring about and fulfill the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant no longer exists, and it was fulfilled. The new chosen people are now the Roman Catholics. Again, ARM has a tape available on this. You may obtain it if you wish. But the point is, as St. Paul writes, God does not turn his back. He cannot go against things. He cannot go against his word. Once he commits himself, it is that way forever. So therefore, the Jews do have a special status and always will have a special status in the concept of God's creation and in the value of God's creation. They always will be a special people because they are related to our Blessed Mother by blood. The rest of us are related by adoption only. And therefore, anti-Semitism, the hatred of the Jew simply because he is a Jew, is against Catholic teachings for two reasons. Number one, it is wrong to hate any human being. Number two, it is wrong to hate these special people who still have a special place in the heart of God.
To summarize, to conclude, the Catholic Church is not the enemy of the Jew, but the protector of the Jew. History shows this. However, because of the collective paranoia that has unfortunately become a characteristic of the rabbinic Jew, that is to see persecution everywhere, to see hatred everywhere, and to see jealousy everywhere, they have attacked that institution which has replaced them in the scheme of things. Yes, they were a light to the world, a light to the Gentile, a way to bring about the knowledge of God to the world. They have been replaced in this status by the Roman Catholic Church. And, as the Aesop's fable teaches, any fool can despise what he cannot have. Well, a variation of that is any fool will despise what he will not accept. Much of the disagreements, so to speak, and much of the antipathy between the Catholic Church and the Jew is due to the fact that the rabbinic Jew refuses to accept Jesus as the Savior, refuses to abandon what he thinks is the Mosaic Law, while at the same time he refuses to follow it. He is a person who is caught in a place where there is no world for him to stay in, no longer accepted by the world or even by himself in his heart as the chosen people of God, no longer following the covenant. He is antagonistic in the same way that the Protestant is antagonistic to the Church, because the Church is the only other institution which makes any claim whatsoever, and of course has the valid proofs to back it up, that it is the people of God, that it is the people to whom God has given His truth, that it is the people who perpetuate and maintain the means of salvation, the right ordering of the relationship between God and men. And of course, it is my personal belief that the true Jew, when he enters the Catholic Church, in a sense becomes twice Jewish. Once because he fulfills, finally, the old covenant that was made to him through Abraham and to him as a descendant of Abraham, and secondly becomes the new Jew, that is, the new chosen people. And it is only within the Catholic Church that the Jew will find his fulfillment and, I believe, settle the spiritual and emotional and psychological disorders which seem to torment these people to this day. With this in mind, I think when we deal with the Jew, or when we try to understand the Jew, we should understand, number one, that the paranoia that this group of people continue to perpetuate has distorted their reality. And number two, that with some patient teaching, we can explain to them that Holy Mother Church is not the enemy of the Jew, but the parent of the Jew, as Holy Mother Church is the parent of all people who live. I hope this tape has been of use to you, and as with all of our tapes, if you have any suggestions, questions, or comments, I suggest that you contact us. Once again, I would suggest that you do get these two books. They are available, I believe, in most libraries by Abba Eban. I would also suggest that there are many, many books out, popular histories of the Jews, common histories of the Jews, histories of the Jews in medieval Europe. I suggest that you would scan these things. I would avoid those books which have hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, unless you are interested in a very serious discussion or a very serious study, and I would not discourage you from that. But I have tried to keep this tape in the same sense that these books were written, for the popular person, that is to say, the person who wants some facts and simply doesn't want to have to spend his entire life in the library learning archaic languages, checking footnotes and cross-references in order to learn them. I don't believe that people learn best that way. Your speaker has been Vin Lewis, and again, this tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. You may contact us at 55 Palen, P-A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hopewell, that's one word, Junction, New York, 12533. If you wish to call me personally, our telephone number is on most of our literature. Thank you for listening. God bless. Now bear that in mind when you understand the discriminatory regulations as involving the ghettos and involving the discriminatory dress. Ghetto is a word which came about because Venice set aside a certain area of Venice where the Jews were to live, the Jewish quarter. And as Mr. Eban makes clear throughout his book, the original ghettos were not considered negative at all because they allowed and continued to allow the Jew his isolation and his introspection. It allowed them to prevent intercontact between the Jew and the Gentile so that the Jewish identity, that is the rabbinic identity, could be continued. And this is also an interesting point because frequently the Jew is considered persecuted because he has been made to live in a ghetto. Later on, of course, in 1492, Spain expelled the Jews, as many other countries had done before, but we point out two things here. One, it was a civil authority, although it was done by the most Catholic kings, Isabella and Ferdinand. It was done to prevent the Jews from being a so-called fifth column, that is, remaining behind for the possibility of a reinvasion of Spain by the Saracen forces. And it may or may not have been justified by the fact that the conversos and the Moranos, that is, those who pretended to convert to Christianity rather than leave the country, because that is the choice that the Jews had, did in fact lead a rebellion later in the reign. We're close to the end of the tape now, and I did time it this way. What I have tried to do is to show the time of Christianity, briefly, of course, from the time of its founding until the time of the Protestant Reformation, roughly. At that point, the Church lost much of its power, much of its influence in the secular world, and therefore no one could consider the trials or tribulations of the Jews from that point on as instrumental by the Church. But what I have tried to do, and I think I have established, is to show that, number one, the Catholic Church throughout its history